Today, number 82, the riot on Ratapala. This is a choice I made because, unlike some of the suttas that I probably would prefer to study myself, I can actually get my head around this one. There's three that I would suggest if anybody wanted to know what three of my favorite ones are, one from each of the collections. We can talk about it later. I've got them here. But I'm not qualified to comment on some of the heavier stuff. I'm not a Dhamma adept. I'm not an Ajahn Brahma or Ajahn Brahmali. This one is not without meat. This has got a lot in it, but it's essentially an exposition of why one chooses to give up the world. And I kind of like it because it kind of reflects my own motivation in taking on the robes 10 years ago. And I'll comment periodically, but it's one of those that doesn't really need to be, unlike some of these heavier ones, doesn't need to be what they call unpacked. It hasn't got too much underlying stuff, so I find it very accessible. But I'm actually choosing this one for four lines at the end, one stanza of the final set of verses that caught my eye, I don't know how many years ago, that I found sufficiently intriguing that I actually wrote to Bhikkhu Bodhi and I said, are you sure this isn't what's meant by these four lines? It'll become obvious at the end what it is I'm referring to. Anyway, we'll start it out. So number 82. You don't actually need to have this in your hand, so if you don't have a copy, it doesn't matter. Ratapala Sutta on Ratapala. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was wandering in the Kuru country with a large sangha of bhikkhus, and eventually he arrived at a Kuru town named Tulakotita. The Brahmin householders of Tulakotita heard, the recluse Gautama, the son of the Sakyans who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Kuru country with a large sangha of bhikkhus and has come to Tulakotita. Now a good report of Master Gautama has been spread to this effect. Now, you recognize these both in the English and the Pali. I mean, I'll run through it, and you'll recognize it's one of the chants that we do all the time. And perhaps many of you may be aware of this, but it's just kind of nice to know both versions. That Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. Now that's Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho Vija Charana Sampano Sugato Lokavitu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati Satadeva Manusanang Buddho Bhagava. So that's what we chant, that we're simply elucidating the qualities of the Buddha every time we chant that particular chant. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. I should say, very good. Then the Brahmin householders of Tulakotita went to the Blessed One. Some paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation toward the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. And some kept silent and sat down on one side. So obviously there's a great array of people there, some true believers and some skeptics. So he makes the same pitch to no matter whether you're a believer or not. When they were seated, the Blessed One instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged them with talk on the Dhamma. Now at that time, a clansman named Ratapala, the son of the leading clan in that same Tulakotita, was sitting in the assembly. Then it occurred to him, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is not easy, while living in a home, to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Nowhere in this is it actually given what his age was here, but it doesn't state it. And there seems to be something later that seems to say It's kind of ambiguous, but I'll get into it when we run into the second clue. Then the Brahmin householders of Tulukotita, having been instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged by the Blessed One with talk in the Dhamma, delighted and rejoiced in his words. They then rose from their seats, and after paying homage to him, they departed, keeping him on their right. Soon after they had gone, the clansman Ratapala went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Venerable Sir, I wish to shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. I would receive the going forth under the Blessed One. I would receive the full admission." Now, first clue as to his age. Have you been permitted by your parents, Ratapala, to go forth from the home life into homelessness, which makes him younger than 20? Later on, there's something that comes up that makes it seem, anyway, that it makes it brings this into a couple of questions that are raised. "No, Venerable Sir, I have not been permitted by my parents. Ratapala, Tathagatas do not give the going forth to anyone who does not have his parents' permission. Venerable Sir, I shall see to it that my parents permit me to go forth from the home life. I shall see that my parents permit me to go forth from the home life into homelessness." Then the clansman Ratapala rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, he departed, keeping him on his right. He went to his parents and told them, "Mother and father, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. I wish to shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Give me permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness." When he had said this, his parents replied, "Dear Ratapala, you are our only son, dear and beloved. You have been raised in comfort, brought up in comfort. You know nothing of suffering." I find that one probably the key phrase here, because they seem to feel that the only reason that that one goes forth, why the one renounces the world, is because one has suffered, obviously, and it goes into the four causes. Later on, it enumerates the four causes of this suffering, the only four causes that people in the world generally understand. Now, this guy has been raised, as the Buddha was, in the lap of luxury, and so how could he possibly know suffering? He's been comfortable, he's been well healed, he's got friends and relatives, he's not sick. They just don't understand. And I've often been asked myself, why did I join up? Because there was not all those things wrong with me. I mean, I wasn't a kid, but the fact was that I'd led a pretty good life. So it's interesting that people seem to feel there's got to be something wrong with you, and you've got to sort of have given up on normal life to actually become a monk. And that's not necessarily true, and we'll get into that later too. Even in the case of your death, we would lose you unwillingly. So how could we give you our permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness while you are still living? For the second time, for the third time, the clansman Ratapala said to his parents, "Mother and father, give me permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness." They always, throughout the suttas, they always asked any question of the Buddha or anybody else. They asked three times, and then after three times, they sort of pack it in, and then they draw the line. They say, okay, for the third time, his parents replied, "Dear Ratapala, how could we give you permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness while you are still living?" Then, not receiving his parents' permission to go forth, on this third request, the clansman Ratapala lay down there on the bare floor, saying, "Right here, I shall either die or receive the going forth." In the notes, it says that because he was prepared to die in order to... he was prepared to die if he wasn't given the chance to take on the holy life. He was known by the Buddha as foremost of those who went forth out of faith. So he gets a few points for that. Then the clansman Ratapala's parents said to him, "Dear Ratapala, you are our only son, dear and beloved. You have been raised in comfort, brought up in comfort. You know nothing of suffering. Dear Ratapala, get up. Dear Ratapala, eat, drink, and amuse yourself. While eating, drinking, and amusing yourself, you can be happy, enjoying sensual pleasures and making merit. We do not permit you to go forth from the home life into homelessness. Even in the case of your death, we would lose you unwillingly. So how could we give you our permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness while you're still living?" When this was said, the clansman Ratapala was silent. For the second time, for the third time, his parents said to him, "Dear Ratapala, how could we give you permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness while you are still living?" For the third time, the clansman Ratapala was silent. Then the clansman Ratapala's parents went to his friends and said to them, "Dears, the clansman Ratapala has lain has lain down on the bare floor, having said, right here I shall either die or receive the going forth. Come, dears, go to the clansman Ratapala and say to him, friend Ratapala, you are your parents' only son, etc., etc. Get up, friend Ratapala, eat, drink, and amuse yourself, as though this is all there is to life. How could your parents give you permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness while you are still living? Then the clansman Ratapala's friends went to him and said, friend Ratapala, you are your parents' only son, dear and beloved. You have been raised in comfort, brought up in comfort. You know nothing of suffering. Now, I think it's crucial that probably the friends thought just as much as the parents that he could know nothing of suffering because he'd led such a good life. In other words, suffering cannot arise if you're getting all the goodies. And we see later on how that's the teaching of the Buddha contradicts that. Get up, friend Ratapala. Eat, drink, and amuse yourself. While eating, drinking, and amusing yourself, you can be happy enjoying sensual pleasures and making merit. Your parents do not permit you to go forth from the home life into homelessness. Even in case of your death, they would lose you unwillingly, so how could they give you their permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness while you are still living? When this was said, the clansman Ratapala was silent. Now they do it again, second time, third time, and he's still silent. Then the clansman Ratapala's friends went to his parents and said to them, mother and father, the clansman Ratapala is lying down there on the bare floor, seems to mean what he says, having said, right here I shall either die or get the going forth. Now if you do not give him your permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness, he will die there. But if you give him your permission, you will see him after he has gone forth. And if he does not enjoy the going forth, what else can he do but return here? So give him your permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness. Parents reply, then, dears, we give the clansman Ratapala permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness. But when he's gone forth, he must visit his parents. Then the clansman Ratapala's friends went to him and told him, get up, friend Ratapala. Your parents permit you to go forth from the home life into homelessness. But when you have gone forth, you must visit your parents. The clansman Ratapala then got up, and when he had regained his strength, obviously he'd been laying there some time, he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told him, venerable sir, I finally have my parents' permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness. Let the Blessed One give me the going forth. Then the clansman Ratapala received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. Then, not long after the venerable Ratapala had received the full admission, a half month after he had received the full admission, the Blessed One, having stayed at Tulakotita as long as he chose, set out to wander towards Savatthi. Wandering by stages, he eventually arrived at Savatthi, and there he lived at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove on Anattapindika's Park. Now we leave the Buddha at this stage in the discourse. Before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the venerable Ratapala, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. The notes tell us that before long means about 12 years. Now, the time in the suttas tends to be kind of arbitrary, the designations of it. So the notes tell us, or the commentaries tell us, that before long means that he was at it fully a decade plus, which is actually not too bad for arahantship. He directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming into any state of being. And the venerable Ratapala became one of the arahants. Then the venerable Ratapala went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told him, venerable sir, I wish to visit my parents, if I have the Blessed One's permission. It's rather interesting that he waited until he was fully enlightened before he visited his parents. So he's been 12 years without going home. So his parents probably were understandably miffed, which we encounter later. Then the Blessed One penetrated mentally the thoughts in the venerable Ratapala's mind. When he knew that the clansman Ratapala was incapable of abandoning the training, since he'd completed it, presumably he was incapable of abandoning it, and returning to the low life, I want to comment on that in a minute, but he told him, now is the time, Ratapala, to do as you think fit. The Buddha refers to, or the suttas refer to, the low life as though it was, something kind of wrong with it. I know there's the word, I've always kind of bristled at some of the translations of some of the terms in the suttas, one of which is sexual intercourse is called vulgar. And I've kind of reacted to that, and it turns out that the word vulgar has been translated from something called Gama Dhamma, which merely means the village way. It just means that's what they do in the village, not what we do when we're leading the monk's life. It's got nothing to do with vulgarity or disgust or anything like that, so I find that much preferable. And I think perhaps the same thing might apply to the low life, which seems to indicate some sort of a, again, a kind of a put down, exactly. It's as though you all can do better than that. I think perhaps this is something like that. The Gamadha, this is simply the village way. This is the way most people live, and most of us can't do it, can't do anything other than live a standard samsaric existence as best we can. So I reacted to the low life translation. So anyway. Then the Venerable Radhapala rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, he departed, keeping him on his right. He then set his resting place in order, and taking his bowl and outer robe, set out to wander toward Tulakotita. Wandering by stages, he eventually arrived in Tulakotita. There he lived in Tulakotita in King Kauravya's Meghachara garden. Then when it was morning, he dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Tulakotita for alms. As he was wandering for alms from house to house in Tulakotita, he came to his own father's house. Remember, this is 12 years later. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Radhapala's father was sitting in the hall of the central door having his hair dressed. He lived well. When he saw the Venerable Radhapala coming in the distance, he said, "Our only son, dear and beloved, was made to go forth by these bald-pated recluses." Obviously, now when I first read this, I thought, oh, he sees his son coming. And then one recognizes that he doesn't realize it's his son because he's been 12 years away, and so he's blaming some monk is showing up, and he takes issue with him. Obviously, you'll see this. So, our only son, our dear, was made to go forth by these bald-pated recluses. Then, at his own father's house, the Venerable Radhapala received neither alms nor a polite refusal. Instead, received only abuse. Father, obviously, during this tirade, still didn't recognize the son. Just then, a slave woman belonging to one of his relatives was about to throw away some old porridge. Seeing this, the Venerable Radhapala said to her, "Sister, if that stuff is to be thrown away, then pour it into my bowl." While she was doing so, she recognized the characteristic features of his hands, his feet, and his voice, something his father didn't recognize, although we aren't sure if he actually spoke to his father. But anyway, he got abused for it, despite the fact that his hands and his feet were recognized by the maid. Then she went to his mother and said, "Please know, my lady, that my lord's son, Radhapala, has arrived. Gracious, if what you say is true, you are no longer a slave. Good news buys you freedom." Then the Venerable Radhapala's mother went to his father and said, "Please know, householder, they say the clansman Radhapala has arrived." That's interesting. I didn't notice that. She addresses her husband by householder. Then the Venerable Radhapala's mother went to his father and said, "Please know, householder." All right. Just then, the Venerable Radhapala was eating the old porridge by the wall of a certain shelter. His father went to him and said, "Radhapala, my dear, surely there..." Anyway, it turns out that this translation is sort of incomplete, according to the notes, so it sounds a little it sounds incomplete. "Radhapala, my dear, surely there is, and you will be eating old porridge? Is there not your own house to go to?" "How could we have a house, householder, when we have gone forth from the home life into homelessness? We are homeless, householder. We went to your house, but we received neither alms nor a polite refusal. Instead, we received only abuse. Oh, come, dear Radhapala, let us go to the house." "Enough, householder, my meal for today is finished." I really quite like that, because obviously old porridge, unless maybe it's sort of getting around towards solar noon and he hasn't got time for any more food, but I just think that's rather sweet, the fact that he was quite content to just eat the porridge, hold to his principles, and not tuck in the way he did the next day. Then dear Radhapala, consent to accept tomorrow's meal. The Venerable Radhapala consented in silence. Then, knowing that the Venerable Radhapala had consented, his father went back to his own house, where he had gold coins and bullion made into a large heap and covered it with mats. Then he told the Venerable Radhapala's former wives. Now, this is another clue to the age business, because he wasn't even 20 when he left home, but he's all of a sudden got, apparently, three or four wives. So it's they did marry young, but the relationship that's implied later the girls fainting because he rejects them seems unlikely in a teenager that you'd supply, you know, that you develop that sort of relationship at that age. Anyway, so you're again, this age business is a little bit uncertain. Then he told the Venerable Radhapala's former wives, "Come, daughters-in-law, adorn yourselves with ornaments in the way Radhapala found you most dear and lovable." Then, when the night had ended, the Venerable Radhapala's father had good food of various kinds prepared in his own house and had the time announced to the Venerable Radhapala. "It is time, dear Radhapala, the meal is ready." Then, it being morning, the Venerable Radhapala dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went to his own father's house and sat down on the seat made ready. Then his father had the pile of gold coins and bullion uncovered and said, "Dear Radhapala, this is your maternal fortune. Your paternal fortune is another, and your ancestral fortune is yet another. Dear Radhapala, you can enjoy the wealth and make merit. Come then, dear, abandon the training and return to the low life. Enjoy the wealth and make merit." Quite an invitation. Come, return to the low life. That's pretty attractive, isn't it? Anyway, return to the low life, enjoy the wealth and make merit. "Householder, if you would follow my advice, then have this pile of gold coins and bullion loaded on carts and carried away to be dumped midstream in the river Ganges. Why is that? Because, householder, on account of this, there will arise for you sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair." Then the Venerable Radhapala's former wives clasped his feet and said to him, "What are they like, my lord's son, the nymphs for whose sake you lead the holy life?" "We do not lead the holy life for the sake of nymphs, sisters. Our lord's son Radhapala calls us sisters," they cried, and right there they fainted. So obviously they developed some sort of, with his teenager, I think it's kind of amusing. Okay. Then the Venerable Radhapala told his father, "Householder, if there's a meal to be given, then give it to it. Do not harass us." One thing I was kind of curious about this too, I don't know my Pali very well, but he's using the royal we. He doesn't say, "Do not harass me," and I don't know if that has to do with not self or what, but I just thought it was interesting. He said, "Do not harass us." So, "Eat then, dear Radhapala, the meal is ready." Then with his own hands, the Venerable Radhapala's father served and satisfied him with various kinds of good food. When the Venerable Radhapala had eaten and had withdrawn his hand from the bowl, he stood up and uttered these stanzas. Okay, this is not the set of verses I was talking about. Oh, would anybody like to say anything? Sorry, I'm not giving anybody any space, but any comments? Yes, Barbara.
Just about the "do not harass us," that is referring to the homeless one.
Oh, right, okay, sure. Maybe so, yeah, obviously don't anybody like me either. Right, yeah, no, good point. Right, thanks. Okay, verses. This is what he does at the meal that we do when we give a blessing. In point of fact, particularly in Sri Lanka, you don't actually get only a blessing the way we do at the monastery. You actually get a Dhamma talk. And it's something that occasionally Apichatta will do, which I find kind of a nice thing. We tend to have a formula that I think is not altogether satisfactory. I think it's nice. Even, who was it? Ajahn Brahmali, sorry, would all often read a short sutta before the meal. And I find that quite, not charming exactly, but I think it's sort of appropriate because the chanting is delightful, but if I were in charge, I think there'd be a little bit of English Dhamma taught, because the chanting is obviously in Pali, and some people understand it by now since they've heard it 100 times. But I think, anyway, so he's giving them a Dhamma teaching, a serious Dhamma teaching. "Behold a puppet here pranked out," and he's referring now to the girls, "a body built up out of sores, sick, an object for concern where no stability abides." He's referring now in this no stability to the four teachings that he then fleshes out later on for King Kauravya. "Behold a figure here pranked out with jewelry and earrings too, a skeleton wrapped up in skin, made attractive by its clothes, its feet adorned with henna dye and powder smeared upon its face. It may beguile a fool, but not a seeker of the further shore. Its hair is dressed in 8-fold plaits, an unguent smeared upon its eyes. It may beguile a fool, but not a seeker of the further shore." Hopefully the sisters have still fainted dead away, and they aren't hearing this. "A filthy body, well adorned, like a new painted unguent pot. It may beguile a fool, but not a seeker of the further shore. The deer hunter set out the snare, but the deer did not spring the trap. We ate the bait and now depart, leaving the hunters to lament." The hunters, of course, being the parents and the girlfriends and, you know, all those who were trying to seduce him away from the holy life. After the Venerable Ratapala had stood up and uttered these stanzas, he went to King Kauravya's Migachara garden and sat down at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. Okay, the visit to his parents is over, and it sounds like it probably is going to be the last one. Then King Kauravya addressed his gamekeeper thus, "Good gamekeeper, tidy up the Migachara garden so that we may go to the pleasure garden to see a pleasing spot." "Yes, sire," he replied. Now, while he was tidying up the Migachara garden, the gamekeeper saw the Venerable Ratapala seated at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. When he saw him, he went to King Kauravya and told him, "Sire, the Migachara garden has been tidied up. The clansman Ratapala is there, the son of the leading clan in this same Tulakotita, of whom you've always spoken highly. He is seated at the root of the tree for the day's abiding." And I think it's interesting here that it's obviously so, they're so accustomed to monks doing their thing that he was aware that, and used the phrase, he's there under a tree, how did she say it? For the day's abiding. And as a layperson, one would sort of assume that wasn't a given, but obviously the writers of the suttas want to be consistent. He wouldn't say he's sitting under a tree. I don't know what he's doing. But I just thought it was interesting that somebody who's just a gamekeeper might know that he's actually there for a purpose. "Then, good Migava, enough of the pleasure garden for today. Now we shall go to pay respect to that Master Ratapala." Then saying, "Give away all the food that has been prepared there." So he was going to go have a picnic, and now he's not going to bother. King Kauravya had a number of state carriages prepared, and mounting one of them, accompanied by the other carriages, he drove out from Tulakotita with the full pomp of royalty to see the Venerable Ratapala. He drove thus as far as the road was passable for carriages, and then he dismounted from his carriage and went forward on foot with the following of the most eminent officials to where the Venerable Ratapala was. He exchanged greetings with the Venerable Ratapala, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side and said, Here is an elephant rug. Let Master Ratapala be seated on it." "There's no need, great king. Sit down. I am sitting on my own mat." Another one of those things that he, sticking to his principles, he wasn't about to have a second meal because that's what the rules say, and it also says that we're not allowed to sit on animal mats. So no matter how comfortable may have been, even if he didn't have his own mat, he just had a pile of straw, he wouldn't have sat on an elephant mat, just for your information. King Kauravya sat down on a seat made ready and said, "Master Ratapala, there are four kinds of loss. Because they have undergone these four kinds of loss, some people here shave off their hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness." What about the four? "They are the loss through aging, loss through sickness, loss of wealth, and loss of relatives. And what is loss through aging? Here, Master Ratapala, someone is old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage. He considers thus, I am old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage. It is no longer easy for me to acquire unacquired wealth or to augment wealth already acquired. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness." So once again, it's a last option. It's seen as something if you got nothing else to do and you sort of run out of time, head for the monastery. Because he has undergone that loss through aging, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss through aging. But Master Ratapala is now still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life. Master Ratapala has not undergone any loss through aging. What has he known or seen or heard that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? What indeed has he seen? And what is loss through sickness? Here, Master Ratapala, someone is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. He considers thus, I am afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. It is no longer easy for me to acquire unacquired wealth. That can actually be skipped because the business about the gaining of wealth, I think, as it applies to age, is not really a consideration. So because he has undergone that loss through sickness, he goes forth from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss through sickness. But Master Ratapala now is free from illness and affliction. He possesses a good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, but medium. Master Ratapala has not undergone any loss through sickness. What has he known or seen or heard that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? What has he seen? And what is loss of wealth? Here, Master Ratapala, someone is rich, of great wealth, of great possessions. Gradually his wealth dwindles away. He considers thus, Formerly, I was, I want to mention something about this business of age sickness. It's often seen in Thailand that, particularly with nuns, and I don't want to sort of make any parallels or anything because they don't apply here, but one of the problems in Thailand is the fact, and why a lot of monks don't see nuns as not exactly legitimate, sort of, but not up to the task, is probably the bulk of women in Thailand who join, take up the monastic life, do so when they are too old. They go there because their families don't want them anymore, but also because they tend to be kind of old and sort of past it. And I think you could almost forgive some of the monks for seeing women as, because all they've seen is old ladies joining the monasteries, and they may feel that that's one of the reasons that we're having our current difficulties, because they see women in general in the light of what they've seen in Thailand, and it tends to be the case that a bulk of women who join the monastery, and this probably applies to monks too, though. I mean, the monkdom in Thailand can also be very much like Catholicism in Ireland. You'd have one son in Ireland who would go into business, another one become a priest. And so quite often in Thailand, you will have one son will become a monk. And oftentimes you will have a son, sons will all do a temporary ordination. But the monkhood can actually turn into a profession. It's just something, it's just sort of how you spend your life, and you're not actually after ending rebirth. That's all kind of almost too much trouble. Mainly it's just a place to, I don't know, sometimes it's just a place to hang out, and it's kind of an easy life. So I think that the difficulties we're currently having have to be seen with the Thai monks, the older guys. I think it has to be seen in that context. So, this is how it's seen even in India. They see that the only real reason people take up the monastic life is either because they're too old or they're poor or they're sick. So, like I say, our current difficulties, I think, should be seen in this light. And what is loss of wealth? Here, Master Ratapala, someone is rich, of great wealth, of great possessions. Gradually his wealth dwindles away. He considers thus, formerly I was rich, of great wealth, of great possessions. Gradually my wealth has dwindled away. It is no longer easy for me to acquire unacquired wealth, so I shall go forth from home life into homelessness. Because he has undergone that loss of wealth, he goes forth from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss of wealth. But Master Ratapala is the son of the leading clan, that this same Tulukatita. Master Ratapala has not undergone any loss of wealth. What has he known or seen or heard that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? And what is loss of relatives? Here, Master Ratapala, someone has many friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives. Gradually those relatives of his dwindle away. He considers thus, formerly I had many friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives. Gradually those relatives of mine have dwindled away. And again, I think we can skip the wealth business. Because he has undergone that loss of relatives, he goes forth from the home life into homelessness. This is called loss of relatives. But Master Ratapala has many friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, in the same Tulukatita. Master Ratapala has not undergone any loss of relatives. In other words, he hasn't joined because he's lonely. So anyway, that's how he sees it. Where are we? Any loss of relatives. What has he known or seen that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? Now, when I was reading this, and actually it was just this morning, I was thinking there's a couple of other losses that prompt people to take up the holy life, and if not our holy life, other. It was just because I thought of these two examples. One is also loss of reputation. Loss of good name, and I think particularly of a guy. I don't know how many of you can remember the Watergate scandal. There was one of the, I mean, they were a bunch of really petty criminals that surrounded Nixon, and they broke into this. I forget where it was. It was a hotel, I think. Anyway, they went in there and they were caught, and a guy named Charles Colson was one of them, and Chuck Colson has become a rather leading light in enlightened Pentecostal Christianity. He lost everything as a result of his conviction in court, and he had an epiphany, and he's apparently found God. So there are other reasons besides, there are other losses. I mean, people, you can lose your good name, and all of a sudden, who am I? And you will find, you will end up looking for something to define yourself by. Another one is, a loss of previously held belief. And I think of that, there was, and I can't remember his name, but there was an astronaut who was a pure scientific materialist, an American guy, of course. And he went up and found God up there. And he's now, it's a bit New Agey, but he's definitely found another path. He just says scientific materialism isn't all there is. He says there is something else. And he's doing psychic research and all kinds of other stuff. So there is that kind of loss, too. You've been hanging on to this previously held belief for all your life, and all of a sudden, it kind of runs out of steam. You run into something that kind of overwhelms it. And being an astronaut, I guess that's pretty good example of something that you just couldn't understand before you actually got out there and were able to see the Earth from however many miles away they saw it. And the last one is this one applies to me: the loss of certainty in the benefits inherent in continuing self-indulgence. Now, I lived for 50 years being self-indulgent. I did pretty well at it. I had a good life. And you finally get to a point where you begin to question whether or not that's really enough. And you get everything you want, and you actually end up getting enough. And then you find out that even enough isn't enough. There's another level of operation that you have yet to encounter, and that's essentially why I did it. It was not because I was sour on the world. It was because I'd done it all, and it still didn't seem like quite it. So there's other sorts of loss besides the four the Buddha lays out, and there's probably a dozen others, but these are ones that just came to mind this morning. So, okay, Master Radhapala, these are the four kinds of loss. Because they have undergone these four kinds of loss, some people here shave off their hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Master Radhapala has not undergone any of these. What has he known or seen or heard that he has gone forth from the home life into homelessness? He's saying the same thing the parents and the friends did. You know nothing of suffering, at least King Kauravya's definition of suffering and the parents and the friends. Great King, there are four summaries of the Dhamma that have been taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Knowing and seeing and hearing them, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. What are the four? The first one, life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. This is the first summary of the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Knowing and seeing and hearing this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Second one, life in any world has no shelter and no protector. This is the second summary of the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. Third, life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. This is the third summary of the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. Life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. This is the fourth summary of the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees. And it's probably not a bad quartet. It's not really seen as one of the big four, like the Four Noble Truths, but it probably is in a way. It's another way of approaching the Four Noble Truths. But I've never sort of seen it set aside as saying these are the summaries of the Dhamma. I think they're crucial. Anyway, so Great King, these are the four summaries of the Dhamma that have been taught by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Knowing and seeing and hearing them, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Master Radhapala says, life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? What do you think, Great King? When you were 20 or 25 years old, were you an expert rider of elephants, an expert horseman, an expert charioteer, an expert archer, an expert swordsman, strong in thighs and arms, sturdy, capable in battle? When I was 20 or 25 years old, Master Radhapala, I was an expert rider of elephants, etc., etc., strong in thighs and arms, sturdy, capable in battle. Sometimes I wondered if I had supernormal power then. I do not see anyone who could equal me in strength. What do you think, Great King? Are you now as strong in thighs and arms, as sturdy and capable in battle? No, Master Radhapala, now I am old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage. My years have turned 80. Sometimes I mean to put my foot here, and I put my foot somewhere else. Those of you under 60 won't understand that, but believe me, it happens. Right. Great King, it was on account, let me see, yeah, that's right. Great King, it was on account of this that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, said, life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. And when I knew and saw and heard this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. In other words, what the Buddha taught Radhapala, he taught him before Radhapala learned, before he had to. In other words, it's almost like people have described the holy life, the path that we follow, as learning how to die before you actually are dying. In other words, it gives you the opportunity to approach your demise without panicking and without and developing a bit of objectivity about it. Whereas if you wait until you're on your deathbed, you got about that much time, and then all of a sudden all these questions might arise, and you begin to confront the only thing that matters in life, which is its end. I mean, I'm not saying it's the only thing that matters, but it's probably the most important thing. And so what Radhapala is saying is that the Buddha taught him a method whereby he was able to see that you're going to break down eventually. Might as well learn to sort of let go of your identification with that perfect body, those strong thighs, your expert archery, all that. So essentially, he's not saying you can give up the practice. But the idea of defining yourself by these things that you do so well, you can let that one go. So, that's one of the things that I think. That's again one of the reasons I think that I'm doing this is because I just assume not wait until the very end to take the next step.
It is wonderful, Master Radhapala. It is marvelous how well that has been expressed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. It is indeed so. Master Radhapala, there exist in this country elephant troops and cavalry and chariot troops and infantry, which serve to subdue any threats to us. Now, Master Radhapala said, life in any world has no shelter and no protector. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? In other words, he figures that he's got all the troops, he's got no problem. I mean, I'm sure that's the way Saddam Hussein felt. So it's pretty obvious that none of that stuff counts for much in the final analysis. There's always going to be a faster gun in town, eventually. What do you think, Great King? Do you have any chronic ailment? I have a chronic wind ailment, Master Radhapala. Sometimes my friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, stand around me thinking, now King Karavi is about to die. Now King Karavi is about to die. What do you think, Great King? Can you command your friends and companions, your kinsmen and relatives, come, my good friends and companions, my kinsmen and relatives, all of you present, share this painful feeling so that I may feel less pain? Or do you have to feel that pain yourself alone? And essentially, do you have to die alone? Because when you die, no matter who cares about you, you're still doing it on your own. I mean, you might have company right up to the very end, but boy, that next one, you are totally on your own. And this is what you got to get used to. And I think this is what the practice is all about, getting used to the fact that you're on your own. It's the existentialist argument taken a step further. The existentialists say you're always on your own. But they didn't take it past that stage saying that there is a way of getting beyond hanging on to that. What do you think? I cannot command my friends and companions, my kinsmen and relatives, thus, Master Radhapala, I have to feel that pain alone, and I know I'll have to die alone. Great King, it was on account of this that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, said, life in any world has no shelter and no protector. Yeah, I use this, I talk to prisoners a lot, I do a lot of jail time, and I always tell them that because they all are waiting to get out so that they can regain their friends and relatives, their acquired wealth, all that. But I try and emphasize the fact that you get out and you're still in the cage that's defined by your own mortality. And if you can learn to not, it doesn't mean you got to reject your friends and companions and your partnerships and your wealth and your skills and your talents, but it means that you define yourself otherwise. And that's what the practice is about, is how to define yourself more accurately and more accurately. None of this stuff, all the stuff that we usually hold on to support us, in the end, and in reality right now, is kind of, there's a philosopher named Daniel Dennett who described the self, used the analogy of paper money. And he said, we all know it's worthless, but we all have this agreement amongst ourselves that it really is worth what we say it's worth, because it's the thing that holds the system together. But that's how the self really is. It's like paper money. We all agree that we all are who we think we are, because it's sort of almost, it's just courteous. I mean, you don't want to contradict somebody and say, oh, you're not who you are. But we have this common agreement about something that I think is a misunderstanding. And oftentimes, I think people recognize that, but because it would thoroughly stuff, I mean, it would disrupt society completely if everybody sort of was honest about all that, because then it'd have to be a whole new way of living a life. It means everybody would have to become a monk or a nun. And, the world would stop. So we can't do that. I mean, we need support, so I don't want everybody here going becoming monks and nuns. But I think you can go part way and still live your life and still begin to let go of the stuff that we're attempting to let go of completely. To feel the pain alone. It is wonderful, Master Radhapala. It is marvelous how well that has been expressed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Life in any world has no shelter and no protector. Yeah, when I say to the prisoners, you are your only refuge. In the Dhammapada, it says, Atahi anato nato. And that is, you are your, monks, I declare, you are your only refuge. That's you're all you've got. And there isn't any other. I mean, he says, I go to refuge to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, but the ultimate refuge, even the Buddha concedes, is yourself. So that's kind of all you got. It is indeed so. Master Radhapala, there exist in this court abundant gold coins and bullion stored away in vaults and depositories. Now, Master Radhapala has said, life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? Now, he interprets this one way. Now, I've got another take on this, too, because it says you die and you leave your wealth behind. But you talk to any of the Wall Street hotshots in the last 10 years, and you don't even have to wait to die before you lose all your wealth. I mean, there's nothing stable out there at all about this system that we're operating under. It's just a house of cards. And anybody who wants to find his security and wealth is kind of barking up the wrong tree. I mean, you just pick up any paper now, and there's all kinds of ruined men. And Bernie Madoff's just paid off his last $500 million. And you don't have to wait till you die before wealth becomes kind of an empty promise. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? What do you think, great king? You now enjoy yourself provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure. But will you be able to have it of the life to come? Let me likewise enjoy myself provided and endowed with these same five cords of sensual pleasures. Now, or will others take over your property while you have to pass on according to your actions? Now, there's two points in there I'd like to address. One of which is, some guys are lucky. Alan Bond's lucky. He lost it all, and he's back on top again. And there's a few guys I know in Sydney, not very nice people, but they've lost it all, and they've managed to get it back again through sheer willpower and probably a bit of decent karma. So it's not always the case that these failures end up staying failures. I kind of marvel at these guys, actually. And yet, it's funny because it reminds me of a story Ajahn Jayasoro told me once about some people have a phenomenal hanging on power, and it can be done even with wholesome products, projects. In late 1800s, there was an English army officer, I think, was sent to India to paint on canvas all of the frescoes, the paintings in the caves and temples of India. And he spent the next, I don't know, 7 or 8 years doing that, and he got them all. Recorded them all, and he went, and they were sent back to England, and they were displayed at the Crystal Palace, which I don't know if any of you know it, but it was the World's Fair or something like that. And what was the year, Ainsley? Sorry? 1850. Right, okay. Anyway, it was a brilliant building. I've seen photographs of it. And anyway, it had all of these amazing things from around the world. And this guy's paintings were in the Crystal Palace, and it burned to the ground. And he lost everything, 7 years worth of work. So what did he do? He went back to India, and he did it again. So some guys have it in them just to, you know, it can be Alan Bond chasing money, or it can be this guy with a lot more wholesome motive recording all those frescoes, all those paintings again. I mean, for myself, I'd have gone, you know, who needs it? I don't have that kind of thing. But I find that kind of staying power kind of remarkable, even when it's Alan Bond. now, where are we? Will you be able to have it of the life to come? Let me likewise enjoy myself. Of course not. You don't take it with you. What you do pass on according to your actions, the only thing you take with you is your karma. That's the only thing you've got. And if you want to define self as anything, self is your karma. There's only one thing that can truly be, well, not even truly, but it's most accurately how you define yourself is the karma, is the actions you perform. And it's not even the vipaka, which is the results. It's only the actions you perform. The results are not truly you. They occur to you, with you, through interactions. So, but karma is something you do on your own, and that is really the only thing that you can call your own. So pass on according to your actions. I cannot have it thus of the life to come, Master Rattapala. On the contrary, others will take over this property while I shall have to pass on according to my actions. I've got a lawyer friend who says people are continually presenting him with wills where they're trying to dictate the disposition of their wealth after they die. And they say, after I'm gone, I want to make sure he spends his money wisely. And it's not... you can't do that. Sorry, no matter what you say in your will, once you've given it away, you can't determine how it's spent. So some people do try, but it's not even legal, right? On the contrary, others will take over this property while I shall have to pass on according to my actions. Great King, it was on account of this the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, said, life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. And when I knew and saw this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. It is wonderful, Master Rattapala. It is marvelous how well that has been expressed by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Life in any world has nothing of its own. One has to leave all and pass on. It is indeed so. Now, Master Rattapala said, life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. How should the meaning of that statement be understood? What do you think, Great King? Do you reign over the rich Kuru country? Yes, Master Rattapala, I do. What do you think, Great King? Suppose a trustworthy and reliable man came to you from the east and said, please know, Great King, that I have come from the east, and there I saw a large country, powerful and rich, very populous and crowded with people. There are plenty of elephant troops there, plenty of cavalry, chariot troops, and infantry. There's plenty of ivory there and plenty of gold coins and bullion, both unworked and worked, and plenty of women for wives. With your present forces, you can conquer it. Conquer it then, Great King. What would you do? I would conquer it and reign over it, Master Rattapala. What do you think, Great King? Suppose a trustworthy and reliable man came to you from the other directions, west, north, and south, and said the same thing. Conquer it then, Great King. What would you do? We would conquer it too and reign over it, Master Rattapala. Great King, it was on account of this the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, said, life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, slave of craving. And when I knew and saw this, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Now, what I was referring to earlier this hour was to know what is enough. And it's one of those things that a friend of mine and I, both photographers, we both had reached a stage in our lives where we recognized that materially we had enough. And it was quite a nice thing to acknowledge to oneself that I don't feel that need anymore. And it went into a couple of other departments. But anyway, we'll talk about the wealth side and just say that it was delightful to encounter a time when we didn't feel the need to go out and conquer another country. But as I began to allude to, the fact is that when you get to that point, and that means you've gotten as much out of samsara as you possibly can. You've been very successful, and then you still run into the fact that enough is not enough. And that's sort of what I was referring to before. But even if one recognizes enough, it's still not enough, and the holy life begins. Or a changed life, like Chuck Colson or that astronaut, or perhaps some of you good people. It is wonderful, it is marvelous how well that has been expressed by the Blessed One, who knows and sees. He obviously accepts the fact that if he were still in charge, and if he were probably still young, now he probably wouldn't go out and conquer those countries if at his present stage in his 80s. I mean, the chances are he's probably going to, you know, hedge his bets a little bit there. Maybe when he was strong in thighs, he might have done it. But he did recognize the fact that if he was younger, he would probably not be satisfied with anything but everything, as we seem to be in the States. Sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, life in any world is incomplete, insatiate, the slave of craving. It is indeed so. That is what the Venerable Rattapala said, and having said that, he said further, okay, this is the This is the verses I was going to the one of which I'd like to sort of flesh out a little bit. I see men wealthy in the world who yet from ignorance give not their gathered wealth. Greedily they hoard away their riches, longing still for further sensual pleasures. A king who has conquered the earth by force and rules over the land the ocean bounds is yet unsated with the sea's near shore and hungers for its further shore as well. Most other people too, not just a king, encounter death with craving unabated. With plans still incomplete, they leave the corpse. Desires remain unsated in the world. His relatives lament and rend their hair, crying, "Ah me, alas, our love is dead." They bear away the body wrapped in shrouds to place it on a pyre and burn it there. Clad in a shroud, he leaves his wealth behind. Prodded with stakes, he burns upon the pyre. And as he dies, no relatives or friends can offer him shelter and refuge there. I was reminded of the fact that apparently there's an, I don't know if it still exists, but there was a custom in India of wives throwing themselves in the funeral pyre after the death of the husband because they kind of wanted to join him, and they didn't realize they weren't going to, unfortunately. I suppose there's a nice ideal about that, but anyway. While his heirs take over his wealth, it must really get up. If you died and you were able to sort of look down on what was going on with what you'd accumulated all your life, boy, it would get up your nose. I mean, to see your offspring frittering away this stuff. While his heirs take over his wealth, this being must pass on according to his actions. And as he dies, nothing can follow him, nor child, nor wife, nor wealth, nor royal estate. Longevity is not acquired with wealth, nor can prosperity banish old age. Short is this life, as all the sages say. Eternity it knows not, only change. Anicca. The rich and poor alike shall feel death's touch. The fool and sage as well shall feel it too. But while the fool lies stricken by his folly, no sage will ever tremble at the touch. Better is wisdom here than any wealth, since by wisdom one gains the final goal. For people through ignorance do evil deeds while failing to reach the goal from life to life. This is the stanza I like, and this is the one that caught my eye. As one goes to the womb and the next world, renewing the successive round of births, another of little wisdom, trusting him, goes also to the womb and the next world. Now, I wrote to Bhikkhu Bodhi about that because I've always liked the idea of considering my next birth my offspring. I look upon my rebirth as my child. And even though I used to say, oh, well, it doesn't make any difference, my next birth, I'm not going to remember me unless I become enlightened. Now, I'm not going to know what I did. I'm not going to know how irresponsible I was and why I've got such an unsatisfactory rebirth. And you don't know that next time around, but it still doesn't absolve you of the responsibility for that being. And that's how I see this. In other words, another of little wisdom trusting him goes also to the womb. And to me, that's me being reborn. And trusting him goes also to the womb and the next world. And I looked upon that as I say, my rebirth being my offspring. And I wrote to Bhikkhu Bodhi about this, and I said, could this not be interpreted this way? And he just said that he just copied it straight from what Nyanamoli had said, and I couldn't ask him because he's dead. But it's something, he didn't think there was anything deeper in that than just some friend sees you dying and he trusts you. But I like the idea of your next life is your responsibility. And you can take that on as I say, like your offspring. That you treat it the same way, even though it's not going to know that, you know that you're responsible for that being. And just as you were responsible for any child you might bear. Just as robber caught in burglary is made to suffer for his evil deeds, so people after death in the next world are made to suffer for their evil deeds. Sensual pleasures, varied, sweet, delightful, in many different ways disturb the mind. Seeing the danger in these sensual ties, I chose to lead the homeless life, O King. As fruits fall from the tree, so people too, both young and old, fall when this body breaks. Seeing this too, O King, I have gone forth. Better is the recluse's life assured. The recluse's life, meaning the deathless. You're an arahant, you don't die, because there's nobody there at that stage. You pulled up all the roots. And so that's what he's referring to when he says, better is the recluse's life assured, because that's the deathless. Anyway, okay, that's the sutta.